the prayer of my guru. Please join me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Rumi is a mystic of the faith of Islam, lived around early 1200s by our calendar. He wrote beautiful poetry. He lived in the area of Turkey. Entitled Body Intelligence. Your intelligence is always with you, overseeing your body, even though you may not be aware of its work. If you start doing something against your health, your intelligence will eventually scold you. If it hadn't been so lovingly close by and so constantly monitoring, how could it rebuke? You and your intelligence are like the beauty and the precision of an astral lab. Together you calculate how near existence is to the sun. Your intelligence is marvelously intimate. It is not in front of you, or behind, or to the left, or to the right. Now try, my friend, to describe how near is the creator of your intellect. Intellectual searching will not find it the way to that king. The movement of your finger is not separate from your finger. You go to sleep, or you die, and there's no intelligent motion. Then you wake, and your fingers fill with meanings. Now consider the jewel lights in your eyes. How do they work? The visible universe has many weathers and variations. But Uncle, oh Uncle, the universe of the creation word, the divine command to be, that universe of qualities is beyond any pointing to. More intelligent than intellect, and more spiritual than spirit. No being is unconnected to that reality, and that connection cannot be said. There's no separation and no return. There are guides who can show you the way. Use them, but they will not satisfy your longing. Keep wanting the connection with all your pulsing energy. The throbbing vein will take you further than any thinking. Muhammad said, "Don't theorize about essence. All speculations are just more layers of covering. Human beings love their coverings. They think the designs on the curtains are what is being concealed. Observe the wonders as they occur around you. Don't claim them. Feel the artistry moving through them and be silent. Or say, I cannot praise you as you should be praised. Such words are infinitely beyond my understanding." Isn't he wonderful? From Paramahansa Yogananda, his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. This comes from verse 1. The organization of man's body and mind reveals in its detailed perfection the presence of the divine plan. Know ye not that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? Comes from Corinthians 3:16. The Spirit of God, his reflection in man, is the soul. The soul makes its entry into matter as a spark of omnipotent life and consciousness within the nucleus formed by the union of the sperm and ovum. As the body develops, this original seat of life remains in the medulla oblongata. The medulla is therefore referred to as the gateway of life through which the king's soul makes his triumphant entrance into the bodily kingdom. In this seat of life is the first expression of the incarnate soul's fine perceptions, imprinted with karmically designed pattern of various phases of life to come. By the miraculous power of prana, or intelligent creative life force, guided by the faculties of the soul, the zygote develops through the fetal and the embryonic stages into a human body. The creative faculties or instruments of the soul are astral and causal in nature. When the soul enters the primal cell of life, it is wearing two subtle bodies, a causal form of thoughtrons, which in turn is encased in an astral form of lifetrons. These are two words that Yogananda coined, and the thoughtrons are those individualized ideas that come from the high causal world, and the lifetrons are the prana, or the life energy, that comes into the body. The causal body, so named because it is the cause of the two other soul encasements, consists of 35 ideas or thought forces, which I have termed thoughtrons, from which is formed the astral body of 19 elements and the physical body of 16 gross chemical elements. The 19 elements of the astral body are intelligence, or buddhi, ego, or ahamkara, feeling, citta, mind, manas, or sense consciousness. The five instruments of knowledge, the subtle counterparts of the senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. Five instruments of action, the mental correspondence for the abilities to procreate, excrete, talk, walk, and exercise manual skill. And five instruments of prana, empowering the performance of the crystallizing, assimilating, eliminating, metabolizing, and circulating functions of the physical body. These 19 powers in the astral body are what build, maintain, and enliven the gross physical form. The centers of life and consciousness from which these powers function are the astral brain, or the thousand-petaled lotus of light, and the astral cerebral axis, or the Sushumna, containing six subtle centers, or chakras. These are located in relation to the physical body, in the medulla, and in the five centers in the spine, the cervical opposite the throat, the dorsal opposite the heart, the lumbar opposite the navel, sacral opposite the generative organs, and coccygeal at the base of the spine. Coarser forces of the mind manifest in the grosser structures of the body, but the fine forces of the soul, consciousness, intellect, will, feeling, require the medulla and delicate tissues of the brain in which to dwell and through which to manifest. In simplistic terms, the inner chambers of the palace of the king, soul, are in the subtle centers of superconsciousness, Christ or Krishna consciousness, the Kutastha Chaitanya or universal consciousness, and cosmic consciousness. These centers are, respectively, in the medulla, frontal part of the brain between the eyebrows, that is the ajna, the seat of the single or spiritual eye, and at the top of the cerebrum, the throne of the soul in the thousand-petal lotus. In these states of consciousness, King Soul reigns supreme, the pure image of God in man. But when the soul descends into body consciousness, it comes under the influence of Maya, or cosmic delusion, and Avidya, individual delusion or ignorance, which creates ego consciousness. When deluded and tempted by cosmic delusion, or psychological Satan, the soul becomes the limited ego, which identifies itself with the body and the body's relatives and possessions. The soul, as the ego, ascribes to itself all the limitations and circumscriptions of the body. Once so identified, the soul can no longer express its omnipresence, omniscience, and omnipotence. It imagines itself to be limited, just as a rich prince wandering in the state of amnesia in the slums might imagine himself to be a pauper. In this state of delusion, King Ego takes command of the bodily kingdom. Here we have a lucid account of how the soul enters into physical consciousness and then becomes identified with it. And this is essential to understand if we are to understand that we are, so to speak, imprisoned in this body and this body consciousness. There's some intuitive part of us that realizes there's more to life than just what we experience through these five senses. But this world is very demanding, very engaging in its nature. And it's through these pairs of opposites of attraction and repulsion, those things that we feel a positive draw for, usually pleasurable in sense, and those things that we feel repulsed by, or those things that have difficulty, have pain associated with it, we get so identified with the body that we completely fall into a state of amnesia of who and what we really are. This could seem unbelievable to us in one sense, but most people in this room have had some experience, at least some taste, of a higher consciousness, of something greater than themselves. Perhaps it was only a momentary upliftment. Nevertheless, you know in that moment the absolute truth of what you're experiencing. But then the mind comes back down into material consciousness. And when it does, it's as if that uplifting experience perhaps never happened or becomes vague and dreamlike in its nature. And now you're back into your default mode, the ego mode. Now the only reason that your ego is the default mode is because you've become so conditioned to its nature. You've identified with it. It is like the prodigal son who headed off from his father's rich estate, squandered all of his wealth and all of his riches, and now he's living in a rather squalid kind of nature. Only in this story, for this prodigal son, he's completely forgotten that he has a father of wealth and means, some place that he can return to. Perhaps it's only a vague idea, or he's become convinced that it was only a dream, a delusion that he has, because other people say, "What? You, this impoverished man who don't have anything, you say that you have a father of wealth, you say that you have a father of great means. You must be daydreaming. That can't be true." And so he comes to believe it, and so he doesn't turn toward home, but rather he wanders further and further afield, getting more and more convinced that he doesn't have any such interior kingdom. Fortunately, we are told by all the great saints, all the great mystics down through time, that this kingdom, that this field of consciousness is our inheritance, and it cannot be sold, it cannot be taken away, it cannot be stained by any of the things that we do, no matter how dark the paths that we travel, no matter how difficult the times we go through. This inner kingdom is always waiting, always ready to be awakened when the time is right, when the soul is finally tired of the game, is finally tired of being limited within its own small confines. But just like a teenager who's learning to sleep in, and waking up is a difficult thing to do. And sometimes he wakes up and then he rolls over and he has a love affair with his mattress and he goes back to sleep again. Just so the soul goes into states of wakefulness and then goes back to sleep. Oh, it takes effort in order to stay awake. It takes mindfulness. It takes pure sadhana or spiritual practice in order to stay awake. And oh, it's just so tempting to go back to sleep again. And so the soul slumbers a while and dreams of being a human in limited consciousness. But when the soul is really ready to awaken, even perhaps beyond the mind's knowing that it is so ready to awaken, it is put onto a journey, a wonderful journey. But a journey that will try a man's soul, that will be difficult, no doubt. Because for whatever that soul has gone out, whatever roads it has traveled, it has to backtrack back through all the different ways that it's gone. So if a man were in a particular town and he decided to go out for a long walk and he went up roads and down roads and through vales and up to high mountain peaks, and finally he tired of being so far away and he wanted to return home, he would have to turn back and retrace all of his steps. And perhaps going out, there was a lot of downhill. And it was fun while he's going out, but now it's all uphill. And he's thinking, why did God punish me so? Because all of these uphills, why isn't it an easy way? Why don't I just be able to snap my fingers, click my heels, and I'm back home once again? Well, it's not quite so easy, because we have to face all of those things that we created in going out. We have to exercise at least as much determination and will in opening the door as we did in closing it. Now, it can seem unbelievable to us that one time we did close the door to infinity, to omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence. And yet we desire to have this experience as a soul. We wanted to come into the soul. And so when that sperm and that ovum come together and create a new cell, an astral light is emitted. And from that astral light, is the soul is attracted to that particular body. And so it begins to imprint itself from the very beginning. The karmic pattern of that individualized consciousness comes into that soul, and it begins to switch on and off genetic patterns. It's given a certain pattern based on the makeup of its parents, which it's been karmically attracted to. And then the specifics begin to get imprinted upon that soul, upon that body. And so the soul, the body, begins to gradually develop, very small at first, granted, but it's beginning to take on the form of that individualized soul. And so the mother will experience different things along the way. Perhaps her tastes will change. She'll want particular kinds of food. She has particular kinds of cravings, because that soul is beginning to make its imprint made upon the body. And so its cravings, its desires, begins to manifest through the mother's body. And so there's a joining between mother and child. And gradually, the child develops through all the different stages. Meanwhile, it's creating exactly the right body for its own karmic pattern. So you see, there are no mistakes in this way. There are only karmic results. There are only outcomes. There are no mistakes. And even if a child chooses a particularly difficult path to come into this world, that is exactly right for that child. Now, that doesn't mean that child doesn't need our love, our compassion, our understanding, our every effort to make that one welcome and to come into this world with all the benefits possible. Of course, that's our role to play, both as parents and as community. But when we see a child come in great difficulty, there's a wonderful, wonderful soul that has been following along this path to some degree. And when he was born into this world, he had cleft palate and other kinds of difficulties. And his mother said that normally, you know, somebody will come up and say, oh, what a cute baby. And in this case, they would get right up to the crib or the carriage, and they would look in, and they would draw back in horror because of the deformities. And yet he's gone through many, many operations. He's gone through much difficulty in this way. And he's a marvelous human being. He's a proficient pianist, a wonderful pianist. And he's a lovely, lovely individual. And he lives with some of the scars, but he's actually a very nice-looking man today because of all the things that have been done for him throughout his life. And your heart goes out in compassion. But equally, we should see with understanding that this is exactly what was needed for his soul and for his soul's development. Now, why? Why would we have such things occur? And I had an example in my own life where, in deep meditation one day, I had a spontaneous revelation of a previous lifetime. And in that previous lifetime, I was just a small child. My mother had died, and my father had gone insane, and there was no wood, there was no fuel, it was bitterly cold, there was very little food. And as it turns out, I was only to live a short time longer in that lifetime. And so I asked God, why this seemingly innocent child has to go through such kinds of difficulties? And to my surprise, God took me back to a previous incarnation. And in that incarnation, I had been somebody who had waged war. And I had been responsible for the death and the difficulties of many families and of many children. And through this experience that I had as this small boy in this next lifetime, it was a few lifetimes later, but it was the next one after that one. And through those experiences, you see, it put into my mind the suffering of a child. And when that happens within the soul, you see, then you look at another child, you look at another person, and your heart can't help but go out to that one because you see yourself in that one. Now compassion grows. Now empathy grows. Now understanding grows. You see how this works? Karma is not just punishment. Sometimes we come to think of it in that way. But really, it's meant to be our instructor. It's meant to teach us about life and ultimately how to reclaim that spiritual kingdom that we have lost and seemingly has gone away from us. Now, I say seemingly because really it is always with you. It is close as your closest breath. It is the life energy, as Rumi talked about here, that moves through your finger. You could not separate the life energy or the prana from the movement within your finger or through your body. You could not separate it through the thoughts that flow through your brain and through your mind. And so these are the things that animate you. They give you life. They give you a sense of being. They give you all of your abilities. And yet, we are like the ingrates who never acknowledge the real source of where our life comes from. And as a result, we feel more and more and more separated from our source. And we punish ourselves, I tell you truly. We really punish ourselves. Because when we don't know that source, when we don't consciously experience it, then we are devoid and bereft of all comfort, of all guiding wisdom, that comes from a source greater than ourselves. And this is really a terrific price to pay. So as we discover this path going home, all these different fields open up to us, fields of consciousness, fields of awareness, but we have to face all of those things that we did. Now, we don't have to go searching out for them. When you sit down to quiet the mind and to grow into stillness, they all come parading before your consciousness. You don't have to go looking for them at all. And the thing is not to give them new energy. There can be things that come up in our meditations as we close and still the mind and internalize it that can make us feel afraid. There are other things that bring up tremendous sense of desire. And so this attraction and repulsion, these pairs of opposites all the way up this spinal column that Master was talking about, each one of these chakras or these wheels of light and energy, each one of them have a positive and a negative charge to them. And so as you rise up into spinal consciousness, into the highest regions of divine consciousness, you face everything that you have to go through, that you've done in this world. Now, they may be beyond memory, but nevertheless, as my example was about previous incarnations, you can take it on faith, if you will, that whatever you are experiencing has come to you because you have set it into motion at some point. And therefore, it's time to pay the bill. We can take the credit card and we can run it up and have a great time with it, but sometime the bill comes due. And in a spiritual sense, you can't claim bankruptcy. You can't just walk away from your debts. They hang around you, and they're just waiting to be paid. And you could say, well, I'd like to defer it to another day. But just remember, there's interest that's accruing on it. So how long do you want to wait? And how long do you want to wait before you experience the freedom of omnipresence, of omniscience, of omnipotence of your soul? You are made in the identical image and likeness of the divine spirit of God. What does this mean? Image is form. And you have taken on these three bodies. First, you started out as pure spirit without any form whatsoever, in pure freedom. And then, because of your own curiosity and your own desire, you chose to take on and clothe yourself with a causal form, a form of ideas. Now, this is extremely subtle, but it's beautiful and it's wonderful and it's very closely aligned to divine spirit when it's in harmony. And out of that came the rays of energy, the ability to move, the ability to have form and color. And it's a joyous expression. And out of that came your astral, or your electrical body. And then finally came into being this physical body. And it's a manifestation of spirit and of mind or causal and energy and astral. Now, without these two more subtle bodies, your physical body is just an empty shell. I remember the first time that I saw a dead body. It was my grandfather's, and he was laid out, as they often are in state afterwards. And I remember looking at him, and I thought, there's something definitely missing. It's an odd sensation. You've probably had it yourself. Some people would say, oh, look, he looks like he's asleep on the couch or taking a nap. He didn't look that way to me at all, although he looked all right physically, you know, in that sense. But there's something definitely missing. And, of course, it was more than just a breathing. It was more than just something. There's something indefinable. It was his spirit. It was his soul that was gone. So we don't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth into the mouth of God. Now, the mouth of God is this medulla oblongata. Now, in the physical sense, this is a tiny nerve cluster, so it looks approximately like an upside-down pyramid that's at the base of the brain. And it's a very, very sensitive and important nerve cluster for the physical body. It's said that if you took a pin and poked it in and hit the medulla, you'd instantly die. It's that important to your functioning. But in the astral or the electrical body, it has its correspondence, and it's here where life energy enters in through the energy body, and it sustains you. And there are some great accomplished yogis who can go long periods of time without breathing, without eating, without having any of the kinds of normal kinds of functions that we think of. And yet they don't die, they're not brain dead, they don't have any difficulty when they come back. And the reason is they've learned how to draw life energy in through the medulla. And they sustain themselves in this way. Once when Jesus was traveling with his disciples, they went out to the town to beg, because that's how they got their food when they were on the road. And so when they came back, Jesus said, they asked him if he wanted some food, and he said, no, I have food and drink that you know not of. Now, he didn't have a secret bag of road treats that he had along with him. He had the ability to draw this life force in through his medulla and sustain his body in this way. So he didn't require food at that particular time. So when these great Mother Nua, a great Hatha yogi in India, he was over 200 years old by records, and he had a disciple who was 135 years old. And the 200-year-old, I have a picture of him, he looks younger than the 135-year-old. But the guru sent the disciple out on a trip all across India, and he was to take no money and take no food or drink. And so he had learned this mudra with the tongue, where he is able to reach it up into the soft palate. And in this way, he was able to bring down this amrita, or mana, as it's referred to in the Bible. And it's actually a substance that gets produced in the brain and comes down through the back of the throat. And through this, he was able to sustain himself on this long, arduous journey all across India and then back. Now, these may seem fantastical to us and beyond anything we could conceive, but it points to the fact that there are abilities and there are processes that are beyond our current understanding and physical science. And these are wonderful things. They point to a future. They point to some potentiality within us all. Now, we can have all of these powers and not have realization of God, which is unending bliss, ever new and unending bliss. This is how Sri Yukteswar defined God realization. When you have a fountain of bliss within your spine and within your being, and this bliss just naturally wells up inside of you, regardless of your physical condition, regardless of what's going on in your external circumstances, this bliss flows up through you, and it brings you complete peace, joy, and contentment right where you are. It's not conditioned on your circumstances. It's something that comes to you. And it sustains you. It comforts you. Jesus said, I will send you the great comforter. And so this is the way that we come into this inner kingdom. And it's the sign by which we identify this kingdom as we begin to enter into it. Do you have that peace? Do you have that bliss? Do you have that joyful nature? And so it's not necessarily that everything in the external world goes perfectly easy for you. Because Jesus, as Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my disciples would have come forward as an army, but my kingdom of heaven is something else. It's not contained within this physical world. And yet it's permeating in the St. Thomas Bible, the one that was lost and has been rediscovered. It says, the kingdom of heaven is spread all over this earth, but who has eyes to see it and ears to hear it? And so when you go into very deeply into this blissful, joyful nature, you open your eyes and you see the same light, you see the same joy, you see the same peace spread out all over this world. You see, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that we're promised here if we would just but make the effort. There's a wonderful book here on Mejda. Mejda means second son, and it's the story about Paramahansa Yogananda's growing up by his younger brother, who used to tag along with him quite a bit, Sananda Lagosh. I'd like to read a little bit. It's entitled, The Manifestation of Mother's Astral Form. I followed Mejda, whom he calls Yogananda, like a shadow. He loved me, and wherever he went, he often allowed me to accompany him. One day we visited a schoolhouse at 50 Amherst Street, site of our mother's passing. As I looked with apprehension upon the place that had been the scene of this tragedy, I said to Mejda, "Our mother died in this house." "A great sage lives here now," Mejda consoled me. "His name is Sri Mahendra Gupta. He is headmaster of this school and author of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Unknown to many, he is an exalted devotee of Divine Mother. Mejda had been here before and wanted me to meet the saint. We had arrived in the evening. Master Mahasya, as we later came to address him, was meditating in his prayer room. When we bowed before him, he embraced us affectionately. His sweet love made us feel we had known him always. He kindly asked us to sit down. He inquired who I was and what classes I was attending. I felt much blessed to be in his holy presence. A large photograph of Mother Kali, garlanded with China rose flowers, graced the altar of his meditation room. When we arrived during his meditation on the subsequent visits, we would remain quietly behind him or at his side in the room, absorbed in the aura of devotion that saturated the atmosphere. One day I asked him if he thought this house was haunted. When we told him of Mother's premonition, when she first entered the house, and how on the eve of our brother's wedding, our mother and cousin had died here of cholera. We had learned later that in the same house a similar incident had happened. The dwelling had been engaged for a marriage celebration. The day following the marriage, the groom and the father died of cholera. And in another startling instance, the groom died on his wedding day, under the canopy where the rites were to be performed. After these tragedies, no one would rent the house. It was believed to be haunted. Master Mahasya told us, "Since the house was vacant, I took it for my school. I am a devotee of Divine Mother. What evil can befall me? I have no fear of inimical ghosts." It is true that the grieving spirit of a man who had committed suicide haunted this house. Thus, the tragedies that were destined to happen anyway were attracted to this place for fulfillment. The spirit tried to frighten me as well. But, as I am blessed son of the mother, he could do me no harm. Instead, he entreated me for deliverance from his plight. I prayed to the mother for release of his earthbound spirit and performed many oblations for him. He was freed, and since then the house has only had peaceful vibrations. One day as we sat quietly behind Master Mahasya, during his meditation, the eyes of the picture of Mother Kali in front of him moved. Seeing this miracle, Mejda and I looked silently at each other in utter amazement. Simultaneously, though his back was turned to us, Master Mahasya said, "What are you seeing?" He knew that we had been blessed to behold the living eyes of the mother. On another occasion, we asked him if he would call our mother from the astral world to appear before us. At first he refused, but we were persistent. Finally, he acquiesced. "Come on Tuesday evening, but you must promise to sit very still and not detain her for long." We readily agreed. The appointed evening found Master Mahasya deep in meditation. We sat behind him without moving for almost 2 hours. The great saint meditated. Then, without turning around, he softly said, "Look behind you and see who's standing in the doorway." We turned and saw our beloved mother smiling at us, her hands resting on either side of the doorway. We cried out, "Mother, Mother!" We wanted to rush up to her, but Master Mahasya told us not to move. "You may speak to her if you wish," she said. "Mother, do you remember us?" we asked. She replied sweetly and clearly, "I keep constant watch over all of you. The Divine Mother is protecting you." Saying this, she vanished. We kept this marvelous event secret from anyone except Father. He mildly rebuked us. "It is troublesome to a soul to make such demands upon it. From that time, I often saw our mother in dreams, but never again did I behold her in the vision of her form as we did that day in the house on 50 Amherst Street. When we enter into our heavenly kingdom, it is the death of all sorrows. It is the birth of unending joy. And if this seems like some fable or fantasy, I can assure you of its truth, and that there have been saints and sages and individuals of realization down through the ages who have assured us of its veracity. Do not doubt that there is an inner kingdom awaiting you. Do not wait for any more time to go by without you seeking it with all of your heart, with all of your strength, with all of your mind, and with all of your soul. Truly, you will never regret one ounce of effort you have ever put in toward that realization. It is the death of sorrow. It is the birth of bliss, of joy within you. And if you would but reach out for it, it is urgently desiring to have that communion with you as well. In fact, if it were not already desiring you, you would not desire it. Ananda Moyama, a great saint in India, she once said, "I first had to think of you before you could think of me." It's a wonderful thought when you have yearning in your heart for divine realization, to think that God was thinking of you first, and that's why you are thinking of Him. Whether you worship God as Divine Father, Divine Mother, or as the omniscient light and life that dwells within you, all forms eventually lead to ultimate emancipation. So whatever you feel most strongly drawn to, think on that, worship that, love that, desire it with all of your might. And surely God cannot stay away from such a powerful magnet of love. Make your resolve today and never look back to enter in to your heavenly abode. Please join me in this closing prayer. It is an affirmation as well as a prayer. So as you repeat the words, feel it in your body, feel it in your heart, feel it in your mind. Sense the truth of it. And let that unleash the power of divine consciousness within you. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Peace. Amen. to the light within you. May the infinite light and spirit ever keep you, bless you, show you the way, and comfort you each step and each moment of your life, so that you might arrive safely and speedily into that infinite kingdom which has been promised to us all. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai.